For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, we got a full set of people in here for the first time in a while.
We're back.
The mastodon hunts are over.
Delicious. They taste like chicken.
Someone finally let Timothy know there are no mastodons.
Oh, no.
Doggone it. Well, I'm going to go hunt snipe next.
Oh, yeah.
Don't tell him. Right.
Don't tell him.
Right. See you in a few weeks.
Anyway, I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and a familiar voice.
Hello.
Gwen Adams has joined us again.
Good to be back.
Great to have you, Dr. Gwen Adams.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming down from Lafayette. It's such a pleasure to have you in the studio again.
It was a good drive. It's beautiful out today.
So. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous day. It took a long time for spring to get here, but now that it's finally here, it's been a very, very nice spring. It's funny. I lived for a few years growing up in Europe.
And
somebody remarked on this. I hadn't noticed until they pointed it out. The seasons in America and Europe are reversed. So in fall in Europe, it is rainy and gross and nasty and muddy and icky in the fall. And then the spring is beautiful and gorgeous and flowers and trees. And here it's almost the exact opposite. Fall is gorgeous here. You've got leaves, not a lot of rain. It's nice, cool weather. Everybody loves fall here. Spring is rainy and nasty and gross usually.
Very muddy. I tell you, with two dogs, it is a chore keeping the floors clean. Man, it's nasty.
Insert Swiffer commercial here.
Right. Oh, yeah. By stocking that.
Now, we are coming up on the end of the school year, and we've got three folks here, all well-educated, all teachers in one form or another, and taking a look at education, Catholic education, and education in general. Are we doing the job?
Who is this we you speak of, Kat?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, I'll go for the broadest paintbrush on this one. Is society in America doing the proper job of education?
Oh, boy.
You know, America is interesting because we have such a wide variety of educational systems, educational perspectives,
programming,
etc. You know, there's a large homeschooling movement that my family's a part of. You've got a very thriving parochial school system.
Yeah, which is unique in the world.
The public school system is well-funded, well-intact, going strong. And then you have private prep schools and those types of schools, and they all coexist. So any given city, you've got all of those going on simultaneously. And I don't know that other places in the world you have that amount of diversity in education systems all going on at the same time.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to say a quick answer would be, it's my assessment that our results are mixed, right? I think that there's, we'll need to unpack this a little bit, but I think that there's some real bright spots and some breakthroughs and things that are very encouraging. I also think there's a lot of challenges and setbacks.
Yeah,
too.
I definitely think the challenges and setbacks tend to outnumber the success stories in contemporary education, at least.
Yeah, and there's so many different kinds of issues and problems. I was just, maybe you've seen this highly watched YouTube video of one of the TED Talks by Sir Ken Robinson on teaching. Does that name ring a bell?
Name rings a bell, but I've not seen
that's
it.
That's the most popular TED Talk, the most views. So, and he's got a lot of books out. He is an educational consultant from the UK. Now he works for the US Department of Education. I think that's right. Anyway, he brings up what is a public school issue, this whole issue of Common Core and testing. And it was interesting because he just gave so much data on how much money standardized testing companies make. These are billion dollar industries. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and the amount of power they wield within education is immense too. Mm-hmm. So I mean, even within the homeschooling world, where you're somewhat exempt from the curriculum wars and all of that that goes on, you are still tied to what's going to be on the SAT, what's going to be on the ACT, what's going to be there in those standardized tests. That still very much dictates what you do, you know, particularly when you get to high school.
Mm-hmm.
But if your parents have enough money, you could have somebody else take that test.
did happen.
There's another set of issues right there.
Oh, my gosh. What did you guys think of when the admissions scandal, you know, just quickly review, multiple colleges, parents paying coaches, and parents sort of working with staff of universities around the country to make sure their kids get into prestigious institutions.
You know, my reaction, I find it interesting to go back and reflect on, because I was not at all surprised, not at all shocked, and it almost was a dog bites man type of story for me. You know, of course this is going on. I bet you this has been going on for eons, and you know, it gets uncovered. Now, the size and scope of that particular ring, that was a little surprising.
Oh,
but,
boy, yeah.
But no, I think, you know, I think cheating for university admissions, that's got to be, there's got to be a long tradition of that going on.
I was really taken aback by the level of corruption, right, and the amount of money that was involved, and the orchestration of the schemes to accomplish the goal of getting you know, these young adults into these prestigious schools. I was a little shocked by the whole thing, to be honest with you. I tend to think of education as primarily a meritocracy, you know, where by virtue of the students' effort and study and aptitude produces certain kinds of grades and results and things like that. So I kind of in that sort of framework. So when and knowing that cheating obviously happens, but you know, but in some cases, right? If I remember correctly, I mean, there were like hundreds of thousands of dollars changing hands for one student, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder. I guess one of the questions that I have that's unanswered is, as a parent, it's certainly not an economic transaction that's favorable, in that, you know, if you're spending $200,000-$500,000 just to get your one child into Berkeley, let's say,
and all you get is he gets in.
That's all you get. Yeah.
What about fails out? In
right.
Freshman,
yeah. Parties,
you know,
and flunks out or whatever. Right. 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 And so and that's all you get. So the value. I'm grappling with is the value that the parent or parents placed on that one event of being accepted into school XYZ in exchange for such large amounts of money is perplexing to me, that how someone gets to that point where it says the prestige that's going to accompany this sort of transaction, you know, $300,000 and my child gets into Berkeley or something like that. I don't know. I just don't see. I think it's just very puzzling to me how you must really devalue money, right, and what it represents, because think of all the other things that $300,000 good that it could have been used to accomplish instead of that one. I don't know. It's just puzzling to me.
Yeah.
Well, I've already shown myself to be highly cynical in this topic.
Same old.
But you know, I think when you're looking at these kids getting into these these schools, and the parents paying that amount of money to ensure that their kid goes to a prestigious school, it's not about the kid. It's about the parent.
Right.
And it's about the image.
The bragging rights.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, you know, I'm the type of parent that has a student that goes to Berkeley. And, you know, so I think it's more about the parent paying to get the value of the prestige and everything of having a child that goes there. If they drop out after a year, well, you know, I had a kid in Berkeley that got there. And so that, I think that's where the monetary value of it comes from, not so much any future.
It's like buying returns. Buying an entrance to a country club or something.
Exactly.
Right?
Or, yeah, really expensive car or something.
Right. It is funny, though. There's kind of a disconnect. So why is it prestigious? I saw the headlines right after I had read Charles Van Doren's article on why he cheated for quiz show.
Right.
Show. Yeah. Right. And there's a film about it. So his dad's name was familiar to me. Mark Van Doren was a Columbia University professor, and he taught Mortimer Adler. He taught John Senior. I know. So John Senior with the Integrated Humanities Program. So there's sort of like this American Catholic, American great books tradition. Mm-hmm. So and partly Mark Van Doren's fame was why they ever asked Charles Van Doren in the first place to be on the show. And the show was rigged from the very beginning, like many other shows. And they did all this name dropping. Charles Van Doren, the son of Mark Van Doren, Columbia University, Oxford, you know, like all these things. And I thought that was so funny that those names would sort of make people all excited, except that like the very idea of education, truth for its own sake, has been completely left by the wayside. Right. It's completely utilitarian. It's completely about money and ratings and viewers. And so then the admissions headlines came out, and I thought, so if you cheat your way into a prestigious university, so like, why do they even care anymore? You know, it's sort of like, it's like a country club. I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
More invitations to be cynical, I guess. But
I know. Or how much longer will those things be prestigious if there's something you can buy?
Right, yeah. Right. And I think education for education's sake, the idea that knowledge in itself or even the virtue that goes into being scholarly, that's lost on our culture and our society.
Right,
I mean, those things are valuable only for what you can get out of them and what you can put a monetary value on. And, you know, that's not just the cheating scandal. I think that's, you know, you look at the way we even rate universities now. They want to move more and more to rating universities based on the jobs and careers that their graduates are prepared for.
Reducing it to the economics.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just had to take a little poll about how many, you know, the professional futures of my own students. So like,
right.
Let me email a couple of them. Sorry. You know?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, obviously part of what you're learning at school is for being able to be a productive member of society and have a job and learn
contribute
the skills
to the
and contribute
good,
to the
right.
common
yeah,
good, et cetera.
Yeah.
But that's certainly not the bulk of it, and it's certainly not the main point of it, and it's certainly not the purpose of an education.
Yeah, and contributing to the common good, really contributing, is kind of hard to measure. Certainly not by your income or the job that you have, you know? Yeah.
And there's kind of a vicious circle there that to be able to measure the common good, you have to have some inkling of what the common good is, which means you have to be educated to be able to do it.
Dang.
Well, my question is the common good a football team? You got that at, for example, I heard yesterday, Ohio State now has enough professional players in the NFL to field an entire NFL team.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, is that the purpose of a school?
Well, Ohio State's always had a professional football team.
And with that, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Has the weather this winter been getting you down? Let us help you look toward warmer weather and sunshine. Mark your calendar for Tuesday, May 21st for the Catholic Radio Indy annual golf outing. This year, we're moving to a great new course, Ironwood Golf Club in Fishers. It's not too early to get your foursome together. You can register online at CatholicRadioIndy.org. We rely on generous underwriting as well. If you're interested in underwriting or being a hole sponsor, call Valerie at 317-870-8400.
For 15 years, Catholic Radio Indy has talked the talk. Now it's time for us to walk the walk, and you're invited to join us. On Sunday, May 19th, we'll be fielding a team of walkers for the Walking for Dreams 5K Run Walk on the Downtown Canal. Funds raised will support the mission of Catholic Radio Indy to convert the culture to Christ through radio. To sign up or for more information, go to walkingfordreams.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with the whole gang, Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and Dr. Gwen Adams here in studio with us. And we are talking about education today. We've been taking the cynical route for the first segment, but
a little bit, yeah.
But no. let's get a little bit more serious about the topic at hand here. And Gwen, you had mentioned Mark Van Doren, Dr. Mortimer Adler, mm-hmm. a lot of these names that are associated with a great books education. They were the ones that kind of, I don't know if you can give them full credit for it, but they were definitely instrumental in putting together the idea of a Western canon that education revolves around a familiarity and a knowledge with 150 to 200 works of Western literature that's the great mm-hmm. books tradition. And so, and they put that into a collection that mm-hmm. was, popular. I think if you were anybody of the upper middle class or upper class for a while, you had the great books that was put together by Mark Van Doren and Mortimer Adler sitting there on your shelves. And in the preface to that, they talk about the value of a classical great books education. And they talk about the changes in education that took place, particularly with Charles Dewey. And what Charles Dewey's idea... John Dewey. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
John Dewey. Mm-hmm. What the changes were that came about. And one of John Dewey's ideas was to try to make education much more of something that was accessible to everybody. So everybody should be educated. Everybody could be educated. And so therefore, it had to be, to a certain extent, dumbed down. Education had to be brought down to a level, particularly mathematics and science, had to be brought down to a level that was accessible to everybody. And so there's this, I think that has created one of what's the fundamental debates in the purpose of education. Is the purpose of education to create a common heritage, a common understanding, common set of knowledge that all of us have in common to be able to have a civil society? Or is education a much more, I guess, of as Tim was saying, a meritocratic type of thing, where education's there to provide you with the tools to go as far as you can on this. And you're going to have some highly educated people in society. You're going to have some people that naturally have an education at a Berkeley or an Ivy League school or, something like that. And the majority of people aren't capable of that and aren't going to have that type of education.
I think if we contrast Dewey, and I think he's really coming straight out of the Enlightenment, contrast, say, mm-hmm. the Enlightenment, a secular version of education, with Catholic education, the Catholic tradition's coming out of the scriptures and the early church mm-hmm. fathers, and Greek paideia, the Greek tradition of learning, which was adopted by the Romans and is really about the human person fully flourishing with all his gifts and his talents, and with moral excellence as well. It's like the whole package. Yeah. So the Christians united those two. So it's got truth and goodness and beauty for its own sake. But with the Christian tradition, you also have, it's not just for certain people. It's Christ called all of us, right? So that you see a lot of educational movements throughout the Catholic tradition for poor people. From any background. So, and that's really been developed over 2,000 years. The way the monastic tradition talked about it, there's a great book by a fellow named Jen Leclerc called The Love of Learning and the Desire for God, which Ooh. I think, doesn't that title kind of yeah. sum up? That's what Catholic education is about. And then if you try to figure out, so what did the Enlightenment change? I think the biggest thing with the Enlightenment is they don't believe in original sin. And they don't really believe in heaven. So we're focused just here on the earth. And since there's no original sin, education, all you got to do is teach people and then they will be better. But there's no idea like we need grace or the gospel.
Redemption.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Dewey comes out of that is there isn't any truth. It's very pragmatic. He's part of the whole pragmatic movement. He talks about, contributing to American society, but in a very sort of like secular, limited way.
Right, in a very instrumental way. Right,
yeah, exactly.
Everybody has to kind of learn where they fit, and they have to have the skills to be able to perform, you know, a particular function.
Yeah, but there's no human nature, no higher.
And if there is, it's conquerable. And I think that's the biggest difference I see between a classical or Christian education and education that comes out of the Enlightenment, is this attitude towards science and nature. You know, for Dewey and for other, I guess, more Enlightenment type of thing, nature is the problem. Nature is what needs to be conquered. Nature is what needs to be put at mankind's service. So,
but we have the tools to do that, because it's not some sort of like, it's not like the fall. It's not some sort of problem that we don't have that we lack the power to correct.
That's correct.
We got it. Mm-hmm. And that's why education sometimes... That's why there's so many teacher movies, you know. Education kind of becomes like a religion. Like, if we just teach, then they will be better people.
We can perfect not only nature, but we can perfect human nature, you know, through education. And we can educate the bad things out of people, which, you know, you take that to the extreme and you wind up with re-education camps.
Yeah. 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 Like a little element of force in there, because like, this is not working.
Right, exactly.
Like,
But you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, Christian education starts from the standpoint that it's only through grace that's accomplished. That human perfection comes about through an interaction and an encounter and a relationship with God. And the education that's provided with that is part and parcel of that, maybe even a means towards that. But it's not what is going to save humanity.
I think one of the more interesting problems of our current time with education that I don't know that we always squarely face is that I think of like educating young people, right? So K through 12, and where by virtue of the school day, duration of the school year, much of that young person's waking hours is involved with contact in the school, right? Teachers, administrators, other students. And because they're going through human development, the point you brought up, Dr. Gwen, about this idea of moral excellence has to, in my mind, accompanies the academic learning that comes along with, because there's this whole notion of students are learning right from wrong. And where one of the problems, I think, one of the big differentiators between, say, the goals of Catholic education, especially the ultimate goal, versus, say, a secular education is, secular education can aim at a variety of different ends that are incompatible with the Catholic faith. So one thing about Catholic education that sort of keeps it within certain guardrails is Catholic education's aims, means, and ends ultimately ought to comport with the Holy Catholic faith. It ought not to contradict it. And embedded within the Holy Catholic faith is, of course, faith and morals. So there's a moral code, moral standards, moral excellence. Once you move into a secular education system, and you can see that with some regularity on some of the states on the coast, where you have, for example, sexual ethics that are coming up at a variety of different ages, variety of different themes, variety of different content, and pursuing things that I would say are contrary to the Holy Catholic faith, but they're free to do that because, again, they're untethered from the faith in a secular sphere, and therefore all sorts of different ends can pop up that they might pursue, and then, of course, the students in that system are going to be subject to it.
Yeah, the academy by nature needs a certain amount of freedom to be able to. And whether you're talking about a university or a high school or elementary school, you've got to have that sort of freedom to be able to explore ideas, to allow the students to explore ideas.
Thomas Aquinas is one of the best examples. You know, so he was trying to see, can we integrate Aristotelian ethics with scriptural ideas, and people are like, no. I mean, it was controversial, but if you go, that's exactly the kind of freedom that you're talking about. Let's explore from a position of faith, but let's explore.
And the ability for students to abuse that freedom and teachers has always been there too. You bring up St. Thomas Aquinas.
Sure,
University of Paris was notorious for the bad behavior of its students, even back in the days of St. Thomas Aquinas. And so you've got that tension.
I hadn't heard that. What were they doing?
Oh, yeah. What do
not to send us on a rabbit hole about scandal and stuff.
What do students do? They drink, they carouse. I mean,
They get into fights. They make merry.
But, I think you were talking about the sort of the moral moral nature of a school, that a school is there for the moral formation to a certain extent, and it shouldn't be incompatible with the faith.
No, it's necessary. Actually, that's the Charles Van Doren or Abelard, so no matter how good your curriculum is, so Charles Van Doren is part of the Great Books tradition, but then he got offered a lot of money to cheat across the nation, so I was thinking he's like, so he has this incredible education that's almost everything I would want an education to be, but it's just not enough. If you don't have the grace and the moral formation, you could fall.
And I think you could fall very fast and very quickly in an academic environment just because of the freedom that's built in. I mean, nothing creates the temptation to sin more than leisure does. And the leisure of scholarship is that's a necessary component. You have to have that certain sense of leisure to be able to mull things over, to think things through, to do academic work, and yet that leisure can be a huge occasion for sin.
And the prestige, which is just because good people were doing honorable things, certain universities, and the idea of being a teacher and academic has prestige to it. They wouldn't have gotten Charles Van Doren if he hadn't had this family tradition.
Right. And I think that's another question of, we put such high prestige on people who are very academically successful. And yet at the same time, we seem to have such disregard for academics. There's an interesting dichotomy there that, we hold people in high regard who've achieved well in the academic world. But then when most people you talk to and you ask them about the importance of study and all of that, they're like, well, it's for the purpose of getting a job.
I hear that all the time in class. I hear it all the time in class. Yeah. It's reduced to, the economics of the pursuit. This needs to translate into a job.
That's very hard because students ask that kind of question all the time. How's this going to help me? Which they might actually really be asking, or they also might be like, I just don't like this. Is there some way we can get out of this?
Yeah. When you take a look at education, what value do we place on the teachers? We'll take a look at that right after this. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave in a moment.
Oh, Lord. Hi, how you been? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry I haven't been picking up the phone lately. Yeah, I've been really busy doing, school and work and church stuff. I know, Lord, yeah. Yeah, baptism, right. It's kind of like 24/7. I know, I'm really sorry about that. Yeah, I definitely still want to follow you. This is definitely something I want to do for life, yeah. Reconciliation? That would be a good thing? Okay, well, I'm definitely going to do that. Soon? Yes, I'm going to do that today. Okay, I love you, Lord. I love you, too.
God's calling. Are you ready to answer? Just a reminder from your friends here at Catholic Radio Indy.
Hello?
Welcome back to The Cave. I'm Dr. Gwen Adams. This is not my show, but I am in the cave of The Cave Guys. And I'm starting off this segment asking them about teaching, what books they've ever read, what advice they've ever had, or what they found most helpful for the vocation of teaching.
I have to admit, we've been talking about the great books. I think the best overview of what an education is and what an education involves from the teacher standpoint is in Plato's Republic. When he goes through how teaching is not so much giving the students something, but allowing them to discover what's already there. Them to uncover. So, for him, it's a process of, the truth is something that's already there that the students already know to a certain extent. And it's a matter of pulling away all the dreck, all the dross, everything that obscures their vision from the true, the good, and the beautiful. You know, for Plato, that's what education was about, was kind of peeling away society, trying to peel away all the layers of illusion and disinformation is probably the more modern word for it, so that they can get to the truth of matters and be able to see clearly the truth of things. So it's not so much giving them anything. It's helping them rediscover kind of what they've already known and already acquired through through their life.
Okay.
Yeah. I would go... I have a couple of ideas that that I'll share. One is, since we're talking about the great books, one of my favorite parts of that is where Adler and Hutchins write about the Great Conversation, which you can actually get as a standalone piece on Amazon. So this idea of a great conversation, which is in what they're doing there is they're and it's like 40 pages. What they're doing is they're inviting us to enter into this great conversation that humanity has been having for the last 2,500 years. And the way you enter into that conversation is by wrestling with the great ideas. And the way we come in contact with the great ideas is by reading the great works and the great books. So I find that incredibly helpful because it ties together why we're reading what we're reading, the purpose to that, getting in contact again, looking for, searching out, and coming in contact with and wrestling with these great ideas, and then that you do that with others.
It's kind of attractive, too, take your part in this long story. That's cool. It's kind of a narrative idea.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great one. And then recently, Father James Shaw died, right? Oh, I think we're all aware of that, right? Yeah. So he was one, he's one of my academic heroes, and he wrote one of it, I've read a lot of his stuff, but one of, for this conversation, he wrote a book called Another Sort of Learning. And in that, it's very, so if you're already have an affinity for the great books, this is a kind of companion to that. One of the critiques that I've heard about the great books that, that Adler and that team put together is that it's maybe a little heavy on Enlightenment thinking for Catholic education. So it's not that it excludes it or disqualifies it, but it just it has some of that. It seems like it might have some of that. Where Shaul goes in Another Sort of Learning is he has a lot of the same canon, but he does have others. And so it's I would say it's even more compatible for Catholic sensibilities. So it's a slight augmentation or enhancement on how, but it's this notion of there are great works of literature, other genres, and we ought to be educated means we need to be reading those. And then his emphasis really is also on, which I really admire, is rereading them because different works like Aristotle's Ethics, we've talked about that a little bit, strikes you, you know, will strike you one way if you're lucky enough to read it as a teenager, something different in your mid to late 20s, and then every decade after that, it kind of hits you differently. You get more out of it and more insights as you grow as a person. You have more life experiences and things like that, and you've also grown in your own education. So those would be my two.
Okay.
The Great Conversation and then Another Sort of Learning.
Okay.
You remind me of a quote from one of my professors, Dr. Robert Wood. And I'm sure this is not original with him. I'm sure he was quoting somebody else. But he was constantly saying, there is no such thing as philosophical reading. There is only philosophical rereading.
Oh,
and, and it's very true. I mean, you do have to wrestle with these books and read them multiple times. And that's one of the joys of teaching. You know, when you teach, you're trying to hand on what's there in the book. And so you get more out of those books the more you teach them. And in a lot of ways, you really don't know a work until you've taught it to somebody else and until you've been able to go through it with students and teach it. That's really when you kind of get to know the book and you can kind of say, yeah, I'm, I guess, more than just familiar with the book. I know the book. So
I'll share two books.
Yeah, please.
I found these really helpful because I thought that they transferred well from the teaching academic world into also youth ministry or young adult ministry or parish life. So one is Christopher Dawson's The Crisis in Western Education, and which is really good
because
he gives you history of education, but then he also gives you a bunch of ideas for teaching through Christian culture, sort of like a full immersive experience in ancient Greek, Roman, Egyptian, and monastic. And I think for K through 12, having those experiences is really helpful. Not just hearing about and sometimes they just can't, you know, especially like a sixth grader, they can't do some of these difficult texts. So to get them interested this way, I think is really helpful. And then a lesser known book by a student of John Senior's. It's called Poetic Education. It's by James Taylor. And he really talks about this.
I love James Taylor. Fire and Rain.
Wait, no.
it's a different one. It's a different one.
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay. There's more than one.
Poor man. He has that name. So he kind of talks about what they were doing in Kansas. But it's this idea of, before you can talk ideas, you need to have sensory imaginative experiences. Yeah. So don't do a poem that has animals in it if your students have never even seen those animals. Go out into nature.
Right.
So, yeah.
Those ideas of James Taylor were taken and they are embodied in Wyoming Catholic College now. And so, shameless plug for a good Catholic university out there. They've taken a great book's tradition and they've moved it out into the wilderness to a certain extent so that the students do get immersed in nature. They get the type of education that James Taylor was talking about and advocating, but at the same time they get a great books education as well. So people have described it as Thomas Aquinas College on horseback.
I think the ideas are there's a lot that you could do if you were a catechist who only saw students, you know, every week, or if you were a college campus minister or something. You might not be able to read the Republic with your students, but you could do a play with them, or you could take them on a hike, and that would go a long way towards kind of contributing to the Catholic education that we've been talking about. So.
Now, it's interesting because when you talk to people, particularly people that are, I would say right now, are Gen Xers, you know, middle-aged people, which is sort of sad to have to admit.
I'm at the beginning of the Gen X. I like made it by a year.
We're still angry though. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But when you ask them what was influential in growing up, I think you're more apt to hear people look back towards youth ministry or church involvement or something like that, rather than a particular teacher or a particular set of books or something they learned in school. You know, youth ministry seems to be where more people are finding their formation. And I think it started with the Gen X generation and then every subsequent generation that's been, you know, that much, maybe even in plus. What is it about youth ministry that kind of augments the academic education that we're getting in school?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is the personal connection. There's also a voluntariness. So, you know, a student, it's just hard to be made to do things and argued into doing the good, the true, and the beautiful, because it kind of wars on human nature, and you're young. So, and some of these beautiful things, they take application and effort. But with youth ministry, you've chosen to go, and often because you have a personal connection to the other students or to the youth minister, and personal connection is all, that's how education really happens.
I think a big chunk of that just comes down to, you know, what is normally considered a negative, peer pressure. Peer pressure in a positive way through youth ministry. It's a matter of you're learning that, you know, if I believe these things, if I want to live this way, it's okay, because you know what? There's a bunch of people around me who think the same.
Right. Yeah. Whereas in a classroom setting where you don't choose, they have not all been chosen to go there. A lot of them, their parents are making them go there. Or you have to go to school or whatever. Boy, haven't we all experienced how one really unhappy student just brings down the whole tone? And you can't control how they're infighting and talking. And if they're like, that's bogus, that's stupid, it's so hard to love something when your peers are criticizing it and criticizing you for being passionate about something. Yeah.
And youth ministry is a different model of education too. It's that discipleship model of you know, you've got the master and the disciple, you know, which very literally means, you know, teacher and student, but we don't think of teachers and students in that context anymore of, these are our students are our disciples. Boy, if a teacher ever kind of came across that idea of my teachers are my disciples. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of icky.
You feel like you'd get in trouble.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. No, in one way, it's true. It has to be explained very carefully so that it doesn't sound like I'm the rock star and because what you were saying earlier is you're not telling them everything. You're helping them come to something that's really kind of been given to them by God, by part of their nature, you know? So, but discipleship can sound like, now my small people, I will lead you.
Right. But I mean, I think we did a whole show on, you know, the idea of parish life being to foster discipleship that, you know, the forming intentional disciples is kind of the catchphrase book that's out there in parish life right now of trying to get that model. And yeah, trying to translate that, I think, into a more academic sense is, it's at least a worthwhile problem to think through.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to be coming up here on a break. And so when we come back, Dr. Gwen, I would love for us to talk a little bit about an area you've been active in, which is what are ways in which we can educate Catholic educators, and what does that look like?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're listening to the Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
What happens when you support Catholic Radio Indy? Local parishes and organizations have a resource to share their message. Listeners of all persuasions get to hear the unfiltered truths of the Catholic faith, and maybe, just maybe, you'll have a share in saving a soul for Christ. Won't you join our mission? Call 317-870-8400 or give online at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Help me feel closer to God each day and just helps me stay grounded in my faith and just keeps me going.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. In the cave still, Kent Blanford, Mark Tuttle, and I don't even want to say guest because you are an honorary member, Dr. Gwen Adams.
Thanks. I remember we inducted Dr. Gwen into the cave.
I had to put my hand on a book and say sign a bunch of things.
Right, exactly. So before the break, I was teeing up a little bit. Love to get your thoughts and ideas. You're teaching a class this summer as it pertains to Catholic education. Tell us what's going on.
So this is at the Augustine Institute, and they've offered
Love the Augustine Institute. Yeah.
They have offered this course in the past, and it's for educators, education administrators, catechists, so specifically on Catholic teaching. So I've been preparing for this class. Also, just in the past year or so, I've had different people come and ask me, you sort of education students, how do I educate myself in Catholic education? Especially, so this, these are studying at getting an education degree at a secular university. Mm-hmm. How are you going to figure out how to translate that into, say you want to teach at a Catholic school? So I've been thinking about this, and I think it's really important for Catholic educators just to get an overview of the history of Catholic education. So sort of what we were talking about earlier, how the Greeks developed it, how the early Christians viewed Greek education, but then also sort of integrated it, and then monastic, and then sort of, you know, John Bosco, some of the movements that, you know, 200 or last century, and then the Enlightenment view, which we were talking about earlier, and the differences up to today. Okay. So just to get that grasp, because I think once you understand that, you have a better sense of, so say you listen to one of these YouTube videos like I was talking about earlier, you kind of get, okay, so I agree with that method, but I understand why he's talking, using that language, because that's the tradition that he's coming from.
Right.
I think that's really helpful. We're also going to spend some time every morning talking about the virtues of a teacher, and I spent a lot of time thinking, like, what does a teacher need most? And this is a little bit different, and I kind of like to hear what you think about this. But I was thinking, given given the way our society is with how many problems there are and the rising levels of anxiety, it seems to me that one of the most difficult challenges of teaching is how anxious the students are.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I was thinking, if a teacher had a habit of peace, it almost seems like peace would be the condition for everything else to happen in the classroom. Ooh. Does that student come in there and feel like it's everything is going to be okay? It's like we can get into something here. And so the virtue of peace is really like confidence in God. So there's some texts that we'll read, and and tap into some saints about how do you cultivate confidence in God, belief in His providence. And I was kind of confirmed in this idea from that video I mentioned, Sir Ken Robinson. He was talking about a school that was a mess in the Carolinas, that they had student bullying and drugs and people beating up and terrible attrition, nobody graduating. And they had a teacher, a principal come in, and the first thing that she did, which really changed things, was she stayed longer than a year. And just creating that stability for the students to feel like this actually matters, this actually is important. I thought, oh, stability, it's my dissertation all over again. But I thought, so to create peace so that the students feel like this is not a war zone, this is something good could happen here. Anyway, so.
And, you know, I think that peace goes a long way to overcoming one of the challenges I've seen, and that's communications.
Oh.
So, you know, and communications is a two-way street, and I think a lot of times you're exactly right. You know, the disruptive nature that a classroom can be puts the teacher in a little bit of a position of either defense or having to be the authoritarian, et cetera.
Right.
And so the communication between student and teacher can't happen. And and right now there's a crisis, I think, with our students of the ability to communicate. I think that leads to a lot of the anxiety, et cetera. But, you know, whether it's spoken and oral and being able to express your ideas in class, or whether it's written, writing essays or that kind of thing, I think the skills that a lot of students have are increasingly deficient in the ability to communicate. And I think that does lead to a lot of the anxiety, but I think you're right. I think there's a role that the teacher can play there through being a peaceful communicator of that sort of aura of comfort and safety and stability, but also being able to listen, having those listening skills that the students are able to open up and express themselves to the teacher.
Right. To be able also, I think, to handle any kind of question, no matter how rudely or defensively a student puts it. Because, you know, a student, they'll say, oh, I don't believe that. You present some truth of the faith, and they'll get all combative, and they'll want to argue. And I think you really have to try to see that this is a child who is afraid for whatever reason. Maybe they're an IVF child, and what are you saying about my parents? If you try to present the church teaching on IVF, I think this is a child who's like defending the dearest things to him.
Right.
So can I, from a position of peace and love, say, you know, like God's going to sort this out. So let's tackle this question.
Right. And am I open in hearing the student story, hearing where the student came from and why the student has these objectives? And is the student in a place where he's able to? I think that's often the problem, that the student's not able to communicate what it is that's creating this wall.
No,
this barrier,
not at all. Not at all. You got a kind of, I think you got like a fight or flight thing going on in the classroom. So can the teacher sort of figure out, okay, how do I do this? And it's not just one-on-one. You got a whole other crowd of people, and they're getting all, you know, some of them are like, the church is amazing. And the others are like, me too. I don't believe that either. You know, so it's a lot of personalities to sort out. So anyway,
I see that a lot when that comes up a lot, I think, especially with like confirmation classes, because of the age that you're dealing with, somewhere between eighth grade, freshman, sophomore year, it's kind of turbulent years anyway, those formative years where they're starting to kind of pull away a little bit from their parents. So they're kind of coming into their own. And then there's some of them are there with feelings of it being compulsory, like you have to receive the sacrament, you know, their parents are saying, and so you have to go to confirmation class, and maybe they hadn't been to religious ed for years before that, and so there's a lot of complexities that go on with that. I know at the college level where I do most of my teaching, at the so I'm teaching at the community college in the city, you know, one of the things that I try to do initially to create that kind of peace is I try to clean up their language right off the bat, because there's a lot of young adults and have I find like vulgarity to be create a lot of tension in the classroom.
Interesting.
So the very first thing I tried, very, you know, classroom expectations is, hey, this is an institution of higher learning.
Right.
Everything has to be PG-13 or less. So no F-bombs, no graphic sexual, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's one of the first things. So just by being able to remove some of the charged language that is part of their ordinary, kind of part of their ordinary way of conversing with others, it diffuses, it lowers the temperature of the class. It's not the only thing you have to do, but I found that to be one of the most effective things right out of the box is that. And then the other thing, other kind of tactic I kind of shock them a little bit with, but I also lead with, your opinions don't matter to me. They're really kind of worthless. So I don't want to hear your opinions, is what I tell the students. And of course, you know, it's even your eyebrows are going up, right? Like, what do you mean? this is what I'm here for, you know, share my opinion. And I say, because we all have opinions about stuff. They're just not very valuable. Here's what is very valuable to me, and what I'm supremely interested in hearing from you is your informed opinions. So once you've looked into some, done some research, looked at facts and evidence, looked at arguments, then and now you're at a place where you have something of value to share, because we all have opinions about everything, right? Whether we know anything about it or not, we have opinions. I don't want to hear those. What I want us to do as a learning community is do the work of getting informed opinions about the things that matter, and then let's share those.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it kind of shocks them a little bit. What do you mean? Yeah, because
I think you could do that with an 11-year-old, and they'd be like, cool.
But I think both of those steps move towards what you were talking about, Dr. Adams, which is creating that environment of peace and creating that environment where people feel secure and stable and safe to a certain extent, where learning can go on.
Yeah, that's great though. What you're talking about, Tim, that sort of it's sort of the teacher saying, "I respect you as a person," almost like we're both human beings made in the image and likeness of God. We're equals. I might be older or more educated, but we're equals. And at the level of respect that I just think makes, you know, it would make a student feel so valued and grow, you know, to think like what I need to do is up my game to take a place at the table. But I have a place at the table. I'm not just a kid. He's going to tell me all these things.
It also gets it back, you know, gets the classroom beyond that realm of verbal combat that I think people, you know, we've
emotivism and the name calling and the pejoratives.
You know, we've talked about this before, that's become the predominant way of discourse within our society. That if your opinion and my opinion differ, the way we sort this out is whichever one of us can shout the other one down and force our opinion on the other one. And so it does take some effort. It does take some guidance and some guidelines to be able to create a classroom where you're having an actual academic discussion rather than, you know, my opinion versus your opinion, mortal combat.
Yeah. And it also, that idea also kind of takes it that this is a longer conversation that extends beyond this particular class period. Because I think that's kind of an anxiety, stressful thing. All right, today we're going to do this unit on cloning. And we're going to like get through this unit and we're going to be done with it. But if you, so you have this really heated argument and then everybody moves off to their next class, that just leaves a bad taste in everybody's mouth. It's not like the student has come to any kind of deeper insight. Now we're done with that unit.
Right.
So, you know, but if you say like your informed opinion, then it's sort of like an ongoing bigger conversation, one that extends beyond that period, beyond the year, beyond the years at the school. That's beautiful.
Well, unfortunately, we are going to have to extend this conversation beyond this period and this show. So we're coming close to the end of our show, but it's been a fantastic conversation about education, the purpose of education, But Dr. Adams, yeah, what are you working on? What, tell us a little bit about kind
yeah,
of
yeah, how do we follow your work?
So my website is bardstreet.com.
Very
and
nice.
I kind of post up there things I'm working on. So I'm teaching this course, and I still have this book that's coming out.
Fantastic.
The big thing I'm working on this summer besides the course, well, I'm also teaching a course on the Creed, also at the Augustine Institute.
Ooh,
so yeah, so that's going to be exciting. But the messiest, funnest thing is I am running a theater camp at Holy Angels Academy in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, fun.
Wow.
And we're going to do Puss in Boots and the Taming of the Shrew. And
oh,
we're gonna,
we might have to road trip down and see it.
You know, not a seminar on Shakespeare. We're going to get into Shakespeare, but we're just going to do the play, and it's a super fun play. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. For Tim O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, for Dr. Gwen Adams, I'm Kent Blanford, and until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.